So let's set our motivation together. And having recognized the unsatisfactory nature of samsara, of our experience, we've come to the Dharma, come to the Three Jewels of Refuge, and we are fortunate to have this opportunity to take dependence upon them, because they actually have methods, and there's a way to get out of this suffering. But if we take a bigger perspective, we recognize that our personal suffering is quite small relative to the suffering of all sentient beings. If we can join that thought with the understanding, even just conceptual, of dependent arising, and we see that there's no real reason to differentiate between ourselves and others, and to hold our happiness as more dear than theirs. In fact, when we look at two strangers, we don't think that one of them deserves to be free from suffering more than the other. And we should feel that same way between ourselves and a stranger. And so really generating that thought and that wish that we all be free from suffering, we can sit together and listen to the teachings and guide our mind in a positive direction. So generate that thought. My legs don't sit underneath it. So the wish to be free from samsara is quite important, but without the expanded wish to benefit others and to really free them from suffering, we'll never attain the final goal of Buddhahood. I was reading a book yesterday or the day before. It's called Phantoms in the Brain, and it's sort of a on-the-edge science doctor who likes to look at cases that are kind of ignored by other people. So one of the, the very first chapter was on phantom limbs. So I've heard of it before reading this book, but sometimes when people get amputations or have accidents or things like that, they'll have a phantom limb. They'll feel as though their arm is really there. But I always supposed that was just kind of a shock sort of thing, and eventually you get used to it, which I think some people do, but there's also a quite significant number of people who continue to feel as though their arm is still there for, I think one case was somebody after 10 years of having lost their arm, very much felt as though their arm existed and could feel it. They couldn't see it, obviously. Went into this whole thing about how we view ourselves, our concept of our own body. And at the end of the chapter, they had this experiment that they said you can do at home. It's very simple, and it involved, let's see if I can remember, you sit in a chair, and you have somebody sit in a chair directly in front of you, facing the same direction as you. And then you close your eyes, and you stick your hand out, and somebody takes your finger and rubs it on that person's nose, while at the same time taking their finger and rubbing your nose in the same movement, and the more random the movement, I guess, the better. And then somehow the brain kind of associates these two movements, and with your eyes closed, all of a sudden, within seconds, your body feels as though your nose is 3 feet long. And just your mind shifts its paradigm of what my body is, and it, all of a sudden you feel that way. It's, well, there's my nose is 3 feet long. That's strange. Then they went further, and they said they did it with an inanimate object. They touched the hand at the same pattern that they touched a table, but the person wasn't able to see their hand. Their hand was under the table, but they could see the finger touching the table at the same pattern. And within, not for everybody, but for many people, they actually were able to feel the table. At least it seemed as though they were. Their mind had adjusted to fit what they were experiencing. It shifted its idea. You know, it's quite a strange thing, but an interesting thing to conjoin with the Dharma, in the sense that if we know from the Dharma teachings that our mind is formless, you know, doesn't exist in a findable place, it's pervasive, then why can't we shift the way we see ourselves to include more than just our body and our personality and all these other things we normally conceive of? Not to say that we should try to expand our body so that we feel as though our body is the whole world of the universe. Nothing like that would be a little bit off. But expanding the idea of self to include more, and to just really think there really isn't any difference between me and at the real base level, the emptiness of inherent existence, there's no difference between me and you. There's no findable difference because there's no findable me. And if there's no findable difference and the mind pervades all of space, then why can't we include everybody in our concept of ourself? And from that, just that idea, thinking about that that way, what it would feel like to, obviously, like I said, we're not feeling their body, so if they cut themselves, we wouldn't, you know, go, ah, you know, but there would be a sort of empathy in this way of feeling more than just sorry or pity for them, but really feeling as though in their getting harmed, we ourselves are being harmed. That's a powerful, powerful thought. So that was just something I was turning over. Very, very interesting book. It's quite interesting. They go into what the self is at the end of the book and go on. And I started looking at it, and I realized it was very much the description of self that fits with the Sutantrika school of tenets. So, actually, I think it was very much the Atman, the permanent Unitarian independent. And that was kind of when they started describing the self. That's what they were describing. So first there's the you that continues on, and, you know, it doesn't change. And then it's unitary in the sense that it's not, you know, but they don't use those words. But it's quite interesting. It's like, wait a minute. I don't know. I don't think I'm permanent or unitary. Okay, so we're going to kind of do a review today a little bit, sort of different. Venerable thought it would be a good idea if we kind of went through a normal day in the life of a mind trainer. And, you know, what things do we encounter in our day, and how can we use the teachings at these various different moments in time? And so that's the whole point of practice, really, I mean, is to do it in our daily life. These are the main texts. I mean, it's for generating bodhicitta, and that includes doing Tonglin and the very specific points of generating the 7-point cause and effect. Is what it is. Right? 7-point cause and effect? Yeah. So all this mind training is not necessarily included in the 7-point. I mean, if you asked where does all these the things that we've talked about in the last couple of weeks, the maxims and the pithy sort of sayings, where do they fit in there? They don't exactly sort of fit in those 7 points. But these are how we practice through our day, so that when we come back to the cushion and we start doing our other practices, we will have carried our practice on, rather than starting anew every time we sit down, going back to the foundry and re-smelting every time we want to practice. Instead, we carry it on and on and on. And then when we sit down again, we're that much further ahead, and we can really take it further in our practice. So I have a few sort of things to go through with it. But if anybody else, as we're going, thinks of different situations that we could maybe put together at the end, let's just maybe throw that, if there's time, we'll just throw it together. So this is just a general what we might do during the day. So the first thing we do, of course, is we wake up and we set our motivation. We do our recitations and whatever our commitments are for the morning. Personally, I have more than just the refuge commitments, but if you have refuge, then you have some commitments to do every morning when you wake up, generate bodhicitta, take refuge. And so one of the precepts of mind training is there are two activities at the beginning and at the end. So that's what that's talking about, is every morning when we wake up, we have to think of the Dharma, and every night when we go to sleep, we have to think of the Dharma. This has a very specific way. Set a strong resolve to eliminate unwholesome activities and acquire their antidotes. So that's something we should do every morning. That's, I think that's included in our refuge, in taking refuge, that is taking refuge. But I think to take that a bit further is to do anything we can in the morning while our mind is still fresh and it doesn't have any other garbage in there that can carry some Dharma on. So one thing I found is reciting text. If you have like a scripture or text memorized, is to just recite that. And even if you're half asleep and you're not paying attention to it, it keeps you moving on the Dharma until your mind starts to wake up. And then as you're starting to kind of come to from your sleepy eyes and you know, really starting, maybe halfway through, say, the Heart Sutra, and all of a sudden you like have this fresh mind and you're in the middle of reciting the Heart Sutra. And that's just a very pleasant way to start off, and it makes practicing very easy because you feel close to the Dharma practice. Then you just want to continue. You don't, you know, sometimes you wake up in the morning and say, like, I don't want to get to the cushion, it's too early. And but if you're already doing it, then it's kind of, why not? Okay, some of these pithy sayings, there are quite a number of them. I think we can use them in more ways than one. We can think about the meaning of them, but we can also really take the words and use it as kind of a gatha, as we did the 47 gathas. And so, you know, there's like, don't wait in ambush. It's kind of very pithy, and you can use that, you know, to remind yourself, oh yeah, I shouldn't be trying to get after other people when they're, you know, take advantage of them or attack them when they're not looking. So the first one, after we wake up, of course, you know, we do our sit, or we might go to breakfast, and so we eat our breakfast, and we one of the good things to use there is avoid poisonous food. So we're eating, so we should avoid poisonous food. And that's just like, we obviously, our food probably isn't poisoned. Hopefully, it might be old, but it's probably not poisoned. That's just botulism or something. But that's just a reminder that's very easy to do. And so not just avoid poisonous food. So generally food nourishes the body, but if it's poisoned, it can cause death. So similarly, the state of enlightenment springs from listening, contemplating, and so forth. But if they are polluted by misconceptions, such as the eight worldly concerns and selfish thoughts, then they can take the life of liberation and omniscience. They can take the life of liberation and omniscience. That doesn't sound right. They can take the life. Okay, well, they can... Anyway, we get the point. They can mess up our time effect. They can ruin our opportunity to get liberated. Because if we're holding any sort of eight-worldly concerns mixed in with our that's the real tricky part. Mixed in with our real highest aspirations, if we start mixing in those worldly concerns, and it is, it's much like poisonous food, a very wonderful food that could nourish your body, but it has poison. There's nothing wrong with the food except for the poison that's in it. And now the whole the food is completely ruined. So one of the I like the Kadampa masters there. They've got pretty good sayings. One of the Geshe Chekwa? I don't know, it's not in this text, but one of the things he has a sort of little saying, and he says he says, nowadays, even the greatest practitioners mix worldly concerns with their Dharma practice. Wow. That's not today, but of course it is still today, but, you know, of course, Geshe Chekwa wasn't alive last year, but his saying is, even highly realized beings, obviously if you've realized, had the path of seeing, then it's a little bit different, but between where you start the path and the path of seeing, there's a huge, especially for the Mahayana practice, I mean, it's huge. So, and in there, you actually, there are a lot of steps that happen, and you can actually gain quite a lot of good qualities before you actually get to that point. Enough good qualities to be worthy of venerance, of venerable, someone who is... has real Dharma practice, but hasn't necessarily realized emptiness directly. So, until that point, you could be quite a great practitioner and start mixing some poison in your food. And he says, he continues on, do you think that of these practitioners, any of them will attain enlightenment? And then he says, not likely. He says, do you think that the sheep will rise up against the butcher when he comes for him? Not likely. Do you think that he'll rise up when he's already butchered? Not likely. So that's very, very strong. Like, we don't have time. There's not... We can't... Life is short, and the butcher's coming. And in our state of mind, we are. We're just sheep. We don't have... real deep understanding. We're very ignorant. And we, at least in my experience, even when we get some sort of understanding of a Dharma topic, we lose it. I lose it very quickly. It feels so profound. And I say, you know, this is how I want to live my life. And then, you know, give it a week. I'm just kind of back going after hot cocoa or whatever else. That's very ignorant. Very ignorant. That's active ignorance. We choose to ignore the things that we feel in our heart because, well, maybe because they're too much of a paradigm shift for us. We're not ready to shift our mind so much all at once and just kind of say, "Oh, now I'm gonna, you know, full time Dharma practice." We can't imagine that. It's too much. So instead, we'll just kind of set that aside for now, and we'll go back to doing what felt all right, felt good enough. We got something from it, so obviously we were chasing samsara for a reason. There must be something good there. But anyway, so we don't want to, we don't have time to wait for the butcher to come to start our Dharma practice. We have to do it now, and we have to do it properly now. We have to constantly be trying to, I mean, the eight worldly concerns are always going to be mixed in with pretty much everything we do, but to spend all of our time trying to really weed those things out, separate them, and find what is practice. What does it mean to practice Dharma? I found one of the things I was thinking, you know, what is the best Dharma practice you can do? All the other, I mean, if you were to really say, what's the best Dharma practice? What's the best thing you can meditate on? Well, you know, really, that is the best thing you can meditate on. To constantly be thinking, what's the best thing I can meditate on? Because if you're constantly doing that, you're constantly checking in and going, is this the right thing for me to be doing right now? Is this, you know, and you're like a ship constantly gets off course, because out in the ocean you don't have a, you know, necessarily a straight thing you can look at and go towards. So you're kind of getting pushed this way and pushed that way, and you have your little compass. You have to constantly be adjusting the ship to go the way you want it to go. So you, in order to do that, you have to constantly be asking yourself, well, are we going in the right direction? Is this where we want to go? So really, that's really important and useful. Okay, so that's while we're eating breakfast. Think about the butcher. Okay, and then, you know, maybe we have our cup of coffee or a cup of Catholic or Perro or whatever we drink in the morning, hot cocoa, and we read the newspaper. And these days, the newspaper or the news is really, it's pretty divisive, really. It's quite a divisive thing. So, let's see what I dropped. So don't speak of others' incomplete qualities. So, we shouldn't criticize people or look at their mistakes and just kind of use that as a pastime, or, you know, because that's what oftentimes the news is. Although, we can use, there's nothing wrong with watching the news, nothing wrong with reading the newspaper. I think His Holiness listens to BBC every day. I think I read somewhere that he actually does it during his meditation. He turns on the BBC, and then he takes, I don't think he listens to the long bit, but just a little bit, and then he turns it off and goes back to his meditation. So there's nothing wrong with the news, but especially in America, it's constantly guided towards the faults of people and who's to blame and what's, you know, I mean, that's sensationalism. And, you know, we're entertained by that in a sense. And actually, that's kind of a, in a weird way, it's kind of a good sign. Because if it kind of points out the fact that we're actually at heart, we're good people. Because we don't, if we were actually at heart bad people, we wouldn't be interested when other people did bad things. It'd be kind of like, well, yeah, that's normal. You know, of course somebody hacked up their husband with a machete. That's just normal. I mean, their husband cheated on them. It deserves it, you know. But we don't. So then in that case, maybe we'd be shocked by news that was like, oh, man pulled someone from subway train that was ready to, you know, run them over. You know, we'd have all these good stories, and then people would be shocked by them. Oh my gosh, can't do that. You could have died. So yeah, it's not a good thing to look at the faults of others and use that as entertainment, but it does actually have a good sign to it, I think. I think my grandma told me that. I thought that was good. Okay, so then most of us go to work, and so we get in our cars and we drive off to work. And pretty often, we get cut off on the freeway. For me, I remember that that always made me pretty angry. I lived in L.A. for a little while, and it's kind of, when you're in L.A., you just kind of, I think somebody once told me that if you haven't cut somebody off and flipped somebody off, you haven't actually gone driving. That wasn't a Dharma practitioner, but, you know, so in L.A., that's kind of, it's a very intense, and especially, you know, we drive during rush hour traffic all the time, and you just, you don't slow down. The people there are actually very good drivers. It's kind of surprising. They're insane, but they're pretty good drivers. Whereas in Washington, people are very nicer, but they just don't know how to drive. So only in Washington do people slow down when they're going to get on the freeway. Stop right at the on-ramp and just kind of, are we clear? So, but anyway. Okay, so the one I kind of conjoined with this was purify the coarser ones first. So when somebody cuts off on the freeway, kind of my initial reaction is to kind of give them the wave, you know. the one finger wave. At least that's what it was before. And so we can really, at that point, we can just kind of say, well, I'll just not do that. I'm not going to, you know, I don't have to go so far as to generate love and compassion for them. I don't have to think of bodhicitta and, you know, imagine Tonglen for them because they're late for work or something. We don't even have to go that far. We can start off with this very gross anger that's, you know, kind of like, who do you think you are? And we can just work with that. And from there, of course, we don't stop there, but, you know, we've got to start somewhere. So not flipping someone the bird is better than flipping the bird. So we can purify the coarser ones first and try to just try to change that part of our mind to begin with. And then after that, we can keep moving on. Or also, as often happened in LA, when I go out driving, you almost every time there's an accident. Drive by an accident almost every single time you go driving. Or you're in one or the other. And so I thought, transform everything into the great vehicle path. So of course this has the word vehicle in it, so that's well conjoined. Kind of sneaky there, slip that one in. But but actually the meaning fits quite well too. It's not just superficial. So what it means by that is we can take the opportunity to generate love and compassion. We see someone else in an accident, whether they're hurt or not. We've been in accidents. It's not that enjoyable. Your day is kind of ruined. You have to wait around for the police to show up, to get a police report, and do all this stuff that's not very enjoyable. So, you know, right there, we can take that and just say, oh, you know, may you be happy. May you be free from suffering. And, you know, I wish that you had a body made out of light so that you could just fly away. You know, really, just because, essentially because at that point, we're driving a car and we're not really doing anything of much virtue. You know, we're just kind of, maybe we're listening to the radio or talking on the phone or probably maybe even getting some of your work done while you're on your way to work. But take the opportunity to turn it into Dharma practice. Okay. So I'm jumping around a lot because it's just the nature of it. This is what I was asked to do. So then, of course, we get out of our car and we have to walk to work. So we can take that opportunity to practice every yoga being performed as one. So this is talking about whether you're sitting, you're standing, or you're lying down, or standing, lying down. Well, this one has dressing, residing. So taking our activities and bringing them into our mind training practice. And that's, I think, personally, taking the mundane daily activities and making them Dharma practice is the biggest part of it, because that's, well, I mean, that's what we're doing most of the time. We're really, I probably wouldn't even sit on the cushion for 3 hours a day if everybody didn't expect me there. It hurts my legs and my knees. So most of my time is spent, you know, making breakfast or swinging a hammer or, you know, picking something up and moving it from here to there. And so those are just so many opportunities to practice the Dharma. And if we don't use them, we're wasting a huge amount of time. And really, we can't expect to have realizations until we learn to use that time. Unless we're really going to actually sit and meditate without getting up for hours and hours on end. But for me, I need that space in between to use well. And actually, I also find that when I take the opportunity, even if I'm just walking, to just be mindful of my body or mindful of the people around me or anything like that, just anything Dharma, I find that when I get back to the cushion, my mind's already focused, I'm already ready to sit, I'm quiet, calm, the mind is sort of subdued a bit, because you're spending all your time going back inward rather than this kind of what Jeffrey Hopkins said, West Westerners were kind of like bug-eyed, kind of like, we're just, I gotta get this done, and we're just, you know, it's kind of, that's our life. So when we're constantly turning inward, we slow down on that a little bit, maybe our eyes don't bug out so much, and, you know, having your eyes bugged out isn't very good for meditation, because they're supposed to be kind of mostly closed. Okay. Makes it difficult. Okay, so then another. Okay, so we get to work. What's that?
That's very true.
We get to work and we're late because, you know, somebody cut us off and there was an accident. You know. Okay, so we're late. Boss, kind of like, what do you show up late? What's this all about? And so then at that point, we think, don't speak of others. Wait, is that right? No, that's not right. Don't make malicious... No, that's not it either. don't maintain inverted loyalty. I guess that's what I had there. Anyway, we shouldn't be mean to them. That wouldn't be very good. I don't think that is one of the pithy sayings. But we get the point, right? You know, somebody's criticizing you for something you did do. You were late, not your fault. You shouldn't hold it against the person. It's their job. They're your boss. It's their job to make sure you get there on time. So, maybe expect that. Expect that if you're late, somebody's going to come complaining to you. Somebody, I don't remember who said this, but start the day and say to yourself, you know, expect bad things to happen during the day. Just expect that, because they're going to happen. This is samsara. Things don't work out the way we want them. Just start off your day and say, well, something bad's going to happen today. Not in like a real negative sense, like, oh, I probably shouldn't even get out of bed, but you know, just be ready for it, so that when it comes, okay, Dharma practice. Turn back inward, turn the focus back on our own minds and what we're doing. And then, you know, boss wanders off, and a co-worker comes up to us. Hey, yeah, boss is a jerk, isn't he? He's over here, you know, complaining about you. You're 2 minutes late and, you know, whatever. You parked in this parking spot. He just complains too much. So then we don't make malicious banter. So take the opportunity. We don't speak abusively in a way that strikes at the heart of anyone who hears it. That is a very interesting way of putting it, I think. In a way that strikes at the heart of anyone who hears it. Because usually we don't think of our critical way of speaking at people, we don't actually think that it is causing them enough harm. It's like, oh yeah, they got it coming. And, you know, I wish I could get them worse than just talking bad about them. But when somebody's talking bad about us and we overhear them, I know for myself, it makes me feel very bad. I mean, it hurts inside, you know, it strikes at the heart. I mean, you know, these people don't like me, they think I'm a bad person, and it's rather painful, I think. So that not making malicious banter is going further than just not being non-virtuous and being cruel, but it's really thinking of, it feels to me as though it's thinking of the other person and really bringing it into a bodhicitta practice, because it's not just about not saying bad things, but it's being conscious of the pain that we cause to other people and the way we can harm them. Chekawa explains, saying such things as, at the time you committed that offense, I did not respond. And it is not clear whether this has been done or not done, and so forth. Okay. I'm not quite sure what that means. Anyway, it's not good to do. Don't speak poorly of other people. Okay, and then the rest of our, as I said, a lot of our time is spent doing nothing much important. I mean, important to get our job done, important to, you know, get our clothes or our food. But as far as what's really important, the Dharma practice, most of our time isn't really spent engaged in formal Dharma practice. So we need to, again, take those opportunities. So here's another opportunity. We're just working, and we don't let three factors weaken. So as we go on through our morning, we're just working, doing whatever we do, whether we swing a hammer or pile papers or whatever it is. Occasionally, when the mind becomes, maybe there isn't something engaging you at that particular moment, you're waiting for someone to do something, or you're just kind of at a pausing moment, we can really think of Dharma. And so one way to do that is not letting your faith and respect in your spiritual masters diminish. So when there's just a pause, something not happening, we can just slow down and say, you know, what would my teacher be doing right now? Even in the middle of all this chaos and flurry and all this work, you know, I'm just stopping for a minute to work with my mind. I'm sure they would have, you know, been practicing this entire period, turning it all into the path, making sure it was all practice. So that's one of the three factors that don't want to weaken. Not letting our attention to ethical training waver. That's really good to think of while we're working, because there's so many nuances in the things that we do, from running very quickly to get something, even knowing that there might be ants nearby or something like this, not paying attention to what harm we might inadvertently do, or speaking curtly to someone that we work with because they're not living up to our expectations, not with the intention of helping them, but with the intention of making it so that they do what we want. You know, so those, we have to be aware of these little, I mean, especially at work, I think, especially in our jobs. And then not letting our joy in mind training lessen. That's Venerable talked about joy last week. That was a really, really powerful teaching I found. Because really, if we have joy in practicing the Dharma, you know, then we do it. I mean, that's why we do all the other things we do. I mean, the first thing you hear in Buddhism is we all want to be happy. And joy is a good feeling. I mean, it's more than just a pleasurable sense feeling, but it's a good feeling in the mind. It's kind of joyous. I don't know how to say it, but it feels good. So if we have joy in mind training, if we have joy in generating bodhicitta, constantly, you know, how can I take this situation and, you know, maybe thinking of it as a game, how can I make this fit the Dharma teachings? How can I fit the Dharma teachings into this? Constantly bringing that up in our mind and feeling good about that, then we'll want to do it all the time. It's just natural, I think. And if we really feel that, we really want to do it all the time, we'll continue to do it, and very quickly we'll have results. I personally feel, anyway, when I have joy, I see that my practice moves very quickly. I'm surprised at how, and when I don't have joy, when I'm trudging through the Dharma, trying, you know, finish this meditation, love and compassion, it's like, it doesn't have any effect. I mean, it's planting seeds, you know, we hear this, everything you do for the Dharma is doing something, so it's not to say that it's not having any effect, but at the moment, at that point in time, it's not having any effect. I sit there and say that, you know, all these jerks around me, you know, they're suffering and they deserve my compassion. And it'll never, ever, I can say that again and again, but if I have the state of mind that's negative, it's not ever going to become Dharma practice. Until I change that state of mind, there's no way that I can get there from where I am. And that's why we do it over and over again, and we familiarize ourselves with the practice so that we can learn to change our mind. You know, okay, so I'm in a negative state of mind. How do I bring joy into this? How do I how do I become happy about doing this? And then the practices can have effects. And the joy leads to more joy. It leads to feeling good about yourselves for doing good things. And you know, so on and so forth. It snowballs. Okay. Yeah. The drawback of this is that lacking heartfelt interest in the doctrine, you will pay only lip service to it. So say this is really most of my practice. I always try to make my practice heartfelt, but you know, there's a lot of rote. You have to keep doing it over and over again, and that feels disingenuous to say all these prayers and not to mean them. But that doesn't mean I should stop saying them. It means that I should change the way I think. So not paying lip service, but not giving up either. Oh, yeah. Okay, and so then maybe, as often happens, we're ready to go have lunch or to have a break or whatever we're going to do next that we want to do. And then something comes up and we have to, I got to get this chiseled away or these files organized before you go to lunch or take a break or whatever. And then, you know, my initial reaction is like, those aren't my files. Like, that's the secretary's job. Or, you know, whoa, I've been doing this over here. I haven't been on chiseling. It takes a shift and not, you know, that somebody else should be doing that. That's their job. So that's the don't place the load of a horse on a pony. You don't really quite fully get the analogy there, but because this refers to slyly avoiding a common problem and passing the unwanted burden on to others. So I don't know why we say that the other person is a pony. It almost sounds belittling, although I'm sure that that's not. I hope that that's not. Yeah, that wouldn't be the intention. So, but I think if we think of ourselves in this way, when we think of this line of don't shift the burden onto somebody else, then we become like the horse. In the sense, we may have been the pony, it may have been a burden for us just as much as it would have been a burden for somebody else. But when we think of the Dharma teachings, we become like the horse. We should be able to bear more, and we can bear more. We have a mind that says, oh, you know. But if we really just say, look, this person, you know, doesn't deserve, I should take some of the suffering on myself and just save that person from a little bit of suffering, then we know for sure that we'll actually be happier. We'll actually feel better about ourselves. It's like the story of the Buddha who, before he was enlightened, went reborn in the hell realms, and who's, I think, pulling a carriage with another person, whipping them, and the Buddha just thought for one second, you know, maybe that person can just take a rest and I'll pull it by myself for a while. And instantly, he's taken out of the hell realms and he was reborn in a higher realm. So we know logically from meditating on the Dharma, meditating on the different points, that when we generate the mind that's willing to bear the load, we become happier, and we become more capable of taking that load. So why not? Why not do it? Let's do it. That sounds like a good idea. Okay, and then we finish that. We get the files in their proper order, or whatever it was that needed to be done. Put the tools away. And we go to lunch, and, you know, just famished. Just lunch. Get our food and rip it open. Food. Let's see what I have attention to. So then we think, whichever occurs, be patient with both. So whether happiness or suffering befalls the body and mind, as was explained in the context of transforming adverse conditions into the path, you should transform it into a factor conducive to accomplishing enlightenment. So I think this one's good because we shouldn't get our food and say, I'm famished, you know, I'm gonna devour this food, and say, oh, but there's, you know, people who are starving in well, in America, you don't have to say China anymore. There's people who are starving in America. In fact, probably less people starving in China now. They're becoming industrialized. But, you know, and then maybe, like, give our food away and not eat and, you know, become kind of austere. Just say, I'm not, you know, it's not fair that I have this, and I'm not gonna accept it. I'm gonna only give it to other people. But that's not what this line is saying. It's saying be patient with both. Be patient with both the pleasure that we get from eating our food, and if our food is poor, or if it's, you know, whatever, gone bad, or we can't get any food, then we should be patient with that also. We should take both opportunities to practice, and not think that just because we, I mean, if we're getting pleasure, if we're getting some kind of happiness, it's because of something we did good, and we get good results from good actions. So we obviously did something to earn that, and maybe we should think more of, you know, what did I do? How can I continue to create these causes? How can I encourage other people to create these causes? I don't know what the causes for having food are. I guess giving food away. So maybe. Anyway, make sure take both opportunities to practice Dharma. Okay, and then throughout the day, maybe some suffering befalls us. Something, let's set an example here, is maybe we get a phone call at work, and our mother or our grandmother or our sister or brother has gotten really ill, maybe had a heart attack, or maybe they were the ones in the car accident. Who knows? So, at that point, I associated this one with train first in the easier practices. So, this is because I thought at that point you could really start doing Tonglen. You don't have to do maxims or anything like that. You can actually start doing real Tonglen and do the actual practice of, you know, even if you can take time out from your work, you know, something very tragic has happened. Take some time out and start meditating and really meditate on the points for generating bodhicitta. And when we do that, we don't have to kind of get out of hand with it, I guess I would say. We do the best we can. So that's the train first in the easier practice. If you feel that it's difficult to take on the miseries of others and give away your own happiness and merits, recall that at present you are training in these practices only on a mental level. So when we get further along, maybe we'll be ready to actually do more. But at this point, take the time, do the practice, use the opportunity, I guess is what it comes down to. It's all about, in my mind, using opportunities. Don't waste it, because something bad happens and we get emotional about it. Our family's sick, or, you know, something emotional inside of us changes. But if we go back to our work and just trudge through our day, we might, you know, get off work and kind of, well, I'm tired, and maybe that emotion isn't still so prevalent, and then we lost the opportunity to practice. So take the time now. Okay, so then you finish lunch, you go back to work, you're working with your coworkers, and, you know, you accomplish some task. Maybe it's maybe even it's a task you did mostly by yourself. But there's the maxim of don't sprint to win the race. This is to try to take credit for some favor you have rendered in common with others. So, you know, multiple people, we went together towards some goal, we accomplished it, and then to kind of feel proud about that, oh, yeah, I did that, and maybe taking more credit for yourself. This actually happens, this is something that's good for me. I think Venerable Simke, it might be good for you also, because we have a job often that involves us guiding other people. So we are doing something, yes, and we also have other people that we're kind of responsible for. And so, hey, look, here's how we're going to do it. We show them how to do it, and then we do it together. Or maybe they just do something very small for us, and the rest of it we do by ourselves. But That's an opportunity to be humble and to just say, no, oh yeah. Yeah, well, when somebody goes, oh, that was a really great job you did on whatever, the forest, or, well, you know, it wasn't all me. I was there guiding people more than anything. It wasn't, you know, I didn't take down all the trees, or I didn't build the cabin, or it's lots of people, or lots of things involved. And so, just to be humble. There was another one attached with that. Oh, yeah, so don't be boastful. So, that's pretty self-explanatory. Don't boast of the little good you have done for others by repeatedly reminding them of it. If it were proper to boast of the good you have done, the transcendent subduer would have said so. But he didn't. So that's straightforward. I like that. I have to write that down. Everybody get a copy of that one. He didn't. But he didn't. That's how it ends. But he didn't. Okay, so then we continue on and we run into maybe a coworker or something like that we don't particularly like. And that's a pretty common occurrence, I think, at least, for me it was. And so I put this one with value in encompassing and far-reaching practice. Training in the awakening mind also should not be biased towards just a few beings, but should be indiscriminately encompass all beings, four types of birth. So, I mean, yeah, we want to have compassion for them. Somebody we don't like, we still need to have compassion for their suffering. And it just, again, it just really comes down to taking that opportunity to change the way we think into a Dharma mind. I don't like that person, but, you know, okay, I should take this opportunity to encompass a far-reaching practice. I should try to invite them into my mind of bodhicitta, of wanting to be happy. This is a very good one. It says, on his deathbed, Chekhova, that's the one with the butcher, I think he was the one who said that. He said, "Say Chungwa, I could not fulfill my wishes, but please place an offering offering to the three jewels on the altar." And when he was asked what his unfulfilled wishes had been, he said, "I wish to experience the suffering of all sentient beings like a pall of black smoke over my heart, whereas I only experience the vision of the blissful land." That's just... that's very good. That's what we want to do. As I said before, it's if we learn to take the step to do the things that our self-centeredness doesn't want us to do, then we find really that we're happier, that we're better people. So what he did was counter to his self-centeredness. I want to take on all the suffering of others. He didn't suffer because of that. He felt better. Something to continually remind ourselves. Feel better when we fight our afflictions, when we fight against them. Even though at first it's very difficult and it's hard. I think for me, what I truly meditate on at that point is to realize that if I indulge my afflictions, whatever they may be, doubt, anger, attachment, anything, then I actually, it doesn't get any better in my experience. And maybe for a brief moment I feel a little bit better if I indulge my attachment, just the briefest moment. But immediately afterward I feel dissatisfied. Or if it's anger, if I indulge my anger, I'm not going to get happier. I'm going to get more angry. Or I think the same might be with doubt. You know, if you start indulging your doubt, you're just going to get more doubt. You're not going to feel better. So if that's the case, then let's try doing the opposite. Because we know what we normally do doesn't. What I normally do doesn't work very well. So when a co-worker makes a mistake, the coworker that we don't like makes a mistake, then the don't wait in ambush is the one I put with that. That, I like to say that to myself. Don't wait in ambush. It just feels, you know, you just automatically get the image of like hunkered down behind like a mound of dirt in the dark. Just waiting. Waiting to pounce on the next person that comes by. Like Angulimala, just waiting in the woods for someone to come by so you can take their finger, kill them and take their finger. So, anyway, I like that. What it means is it's referring to nursing a grudge against someone for some slight and retaliating against them when we're in a position to do so. So I did a bit of meditation on this. You know, what is that? For me, I think the ones that I retaliate against the most, the ones that I hold a grudge for, not much of a person to hold a grudge personally. I know there's some people who have, that's kind of a tendency, is to really kind of cling on. You're a bad person. I don't want anything to do with you ever. And that's just it. I've never really had that tendency so much. But then there's also certain things that get my goat. Is that what they say? You know, pet peeves or something. It happens. And every time I get this sort of spiteful mind or this kind of... And it feels like I'm waiting in ambush. It's just like, so what is that? And I realize that a lot of times that's actually something they're doing is something that it's kind of a jealousy almost, like a repressed jealousy in the sense of I wish I could do that, but I can't, so I hate you for doing it. It's not like I'm going to take it from you and have it for myself because I can't even conceive of getting there. Instead, it's just like, oh. And that, I think, for me, that is waiting in ambush. Although I'm sure for other people it manifests in other ways. That's my special way of going about it. Anyway, there's one more before I kind of wrap up. When we help out our coworker, so we don't wait in ambush, we change our mind. We kind of learn how to be kind to someone we don't like. And then I think this one actually applies to the entire day, is transform your attitude but maintain your natural behavior. This is, again, not becoming prideful, not... being boastful or holy. Being holy, kind of walking around as though you're just very full of yourself. So we should constantly be training our mind, but if we really want to think of ourselves as a good practitioner, then we should never let that show in a prideful way, because if you look at to our teachers, they don't walk around full of pride. His Holiness never walks around like that. So when I'm walking around and I have this sort of like, oh, I'm so awesome, I was able to do this, it's Dharma practice, you know, and I'm kind of feeling good about myself in a kind of prideful way, automatically I should kind of all of a sudden think, well, no, maybe I'm not such a good practitioner because I'm thinking of myself in this way. And it's not what my teacher has taught me. It's not what my teacher has modeled. So... Okay, so we go home, we have some free time, and, well, I guess this is much the same as taking the opportunity in our free time to generate the mental attitudes and do the actions that are going to make it so that we're possible to keep practicing in the future. So here it gives the example of offering service to our teachers, circumambulation and whatnot, taking refuge, and making the wish to never be parted from the awakening mind. So, just taking time when we have free time to do virtuous actions. Okay, anyway, that's what I thought of a day in the life of a Lo Jungpa, I guess they might say. Someone, mind trainer, I guess, mind trainer. So I think really what it comes down to for me, when I look at all this, when I did this whole sort of meditation through all of it, is that no matter what situation we're in, no matter what, it can be used for a Dharma practice or for a Dharma purpose. There's never a point in time when we can't use it. And actually, to the contrary, when we start thinking that we can't, those are probably the times when it's best. Those are the times, you know, when we're so angry and there's no way I can practice Dharma right now, that's when we should really be doing it. You know, those are the most tipping point, I guess you could say. And we get to the most extreme point, and it's so difficult. Our mind is completely lost, and we're angry, and if we can just learn to shift our mind, then everything else seems a little bit easier. Every other Dharma practice seems a little bit easier from then on. So, take the opportunity. One thing I often say to myself is, what is the Dharma of this situation? What is the Dharma here? Not to say that there's automatically somebody trying to teach me something, but there's something I can learn from every situation, even every thought in my mind. I can use it, no matter what it is. In fact, actually, I realized that, like, if I am waiting in an ambush, you know, like that, don't wait in ambush. So if I am waiting in ambush, and if my mind's actually thinking, you know, I want to get this person, you know, for whatever reason, I want to get this person, that can too become a Dharma mind. We just have to shift the object, shift what we're ambushing. We should be ambushing our self-centeredness. We should be prepared to attack any afflictions that come up. So no matter how negative our mind is, it's actually not that far to shift it. And just shift the way we think, the conceptual, the words we use with ourselves, and turn it into readjust the perspective, like a periscope or a kaleidoscope, or I don't know, readjust your perspective. I think that kind of already said this, but I think that this is really a form of sampajana, and that it there's a few kinds of sampajana, and one of them is introspective alertness is the way it's translated. One of the forms of practicing it is to be mindful of your first one's mindful of your intention, and then to be mindful of the method or the means with which you are going about that. So I think these mind trainings fulfill both of those two: why we're doing it and how we're doing it. And if we're constantly thinking of these different points and using them in our day, and we're practicing a very basic, incredibly necessary, important Dharma mind, which is sampajana. You need that mind in order to have realizations, carrying it on through the day, using it, reminding ourselves over and over. So that was my day.
Question about the book that you talked about in the beginning, sort of cite that reference again.
It was called Phantoms in the Brain, I think. Yeah, Phantoms in the Brain. I actually found it very good for meditation. It goes through all kinds of different on-the-edge scientific things that are like mental disorders where people have had parts of their brains damaged so they can't do certain things. One person had visual motion blindness, so they actually couldn't see motion. What they saw was one still frame after another. That was their entire life, was one still frame after another. So they couldn't cross the street because they couldn't judge how fast the cars were coming, because all they could see was the car stopped, and the car stopped here, and the car stopped here. And, you know, so it makes you think, how can you... It makes me shift the way I think about my own experience and the way I automatically think vision. Like, what's vision? You know, okay, so light hits my eyes, it kind of gets turned upside down from the lens, and goes onto my retina, traveled into my brain, and then I watch it on the little viewing screen of my mind. That's vision, you know, it's straightforward, there's nothing to it. But it's like, well, if there was a viewing screen in my mind, then I would need two sets of eyes to watch the viewing screen, and then the picture would get turned upside down, it would travel to that viewing screen. It would just be an end of it. So obviously there's no viewing screen in there, but normally that's how I feel. I feel I'm actually observing the world, and I'm not reality. I'm making an amalgamation of a bunch of different experiences, shapes and colors, and somehow it seems very real to me. So actually I found that a very good book. I suggest everybody read it. Quite interesting. Okay, so this is what we do. Read the book. Do it. It's straightforward. There's nothing to it but to do it. So just start meditating. Okay.
May we sin, attain the enlightened state of Guru Tara, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara's end.
May the deep of explaining and practicing Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of deep and arising, and non-violent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Akshara Vasti Abhi in the West, plural.